Today is April 4th, right, 2012, and I'm Rick Hansen. And I just want to begin by returning to a custom I had for quite a while and kind of drifted away from, and someone suggested I go back to it, which is to take a few moments at the beginning to see if anyone has a question or a comment about meditation in general or the practice this evening. So any question or comment about that? Tranquility was my focus as a setup for tonight. Yes, please.
As we get older, our brain tends to shrink, and meditation is a way to put it up again. And Rick is collaborating with Rick Krasinski, who's doing a brain health teleseries. So he's an excellent.
Thank you. That was a nice surprise. You know, I just noticed a gray hair in my eyebrow. So, like, it's not the first either, trust me. And it is good. Use it or lose it. So one of the things that motivate us, you know, in Tibet, one of the great motivators is the reflections on the finite nature of a human lifespan. So whatever motivates us to practice, whether we're at the beginning of the lifespan or in the middle or even toward the end, you're right. And I think that's, I appreciate that. And there's actually growing research about the protective power of some kind of spiritual life or contemplative practice for the brain in a variety of regards. So great. Any questions about meditation itself, what to do when or anything like that? Yeah, please.
I find that when I come here, I have a sort of higher quality meditation than when I meditate by myself.
Yeah. Many people have observed that, me included, and have wondered about it. I think a lot of the explanation is fairly, I'll just call it, in the conventional realm. In other words, we're in a setting that speaks to us, that tells the mind and the body in a lot of ways, settle down. We come together with other people as a kind of tribe for a moment, for an evening. That also helps us settle down. In addition to that, it is interesting the degree to which people kind of induct each other into their state through breathing, subtleties of posture, and I personally suspect energy fields that science doesn't yet have the technology to detect. And that too draws us in. The mirror neuron system, for example, or other systems in the brain that enable us to be very empathic and kind of resonate with, sympathetically vibrate with, if you will, other people, those are very powerful systems. We're the most profoundly social species on the planet. We're very tuned in to each other. And who knows? There may well also be subtle energies or other factors that are really outside the frame of Western science and the material universe as we know it. But, you know, good company has always been recommended. In Buddhism, for example, one of the three jewels of practice is fellowship. Right, both the horizontal dimension of gathering of other people along the path and the vertical dimension of appreciating people who may be a little further along and have something to offer or are the messengers of those others who are really far along. So that's what we also get, you know, when we practice together. And I think finding a time in one's life for some kind of formal involvement, whether it's annually, quarterly, monthly, or weekly, every Wednesday night, that's a good thing, and this is an occasion for that. Okay, well, maybe I'll move on now into tranquility as a topic to contextualize it. Those of you that have been here the last few Wednesdays probably recall that I'm talking through the seven factors of awakening in Buddhism, and these are causes that the Buddha proposes. We, of course, decide whether we think it's true or not. As with anything I say or anything certainly in the Buddhist frame, see for yourself. Decide what really rings true, and most importantly, what has value for you, what makes a beneficial difference for you. That was the Buddha's ultimate test. Is it useful? So in terms of these seven causes or seven factors of awakening, we began by talking about, or I spoke about, mindfulness. Then investigation, that's the second one. Energy. Last week I talked about bliss or rapture. That's a pretty sexy topic. I even talked about people who have too many orgasms. It's overwhelming. I mean, that definitely got people's attention. But anyway, that was the fourth factor of awakening. Bliss, not sexual bliss, but just rapture, deep enjoyment, deep positive experience with something. And today I want to talk about the fifth factor, which is tranquility. And I'll say more about that in a minute. There's a kind of a movement of these factors. If we're mindful of our inner experience and the outer world, that naturally draws us into a growing investigation. We get more and more interested in what's happening, especially in terms of our own mind. That tends to unleash some nice energy. We let go of things that aren't so helpful. Energy results. We acquire more energy as we gain more confidence in our powers of investigation. That energy then naturally leads to bliss, if you will, or rapture, a fullness, a rising. That wave, after a while, crests and passes into a subtler, more sublime positive state of mind, tranquility. Tranquility, as it intensifies and deepens, can really draw us into non-ordinary states of awareness, which are in the general territory of what's called concentration, which is a kind of a technical term, not for a furrowed brow as you prepare your tax returns, God help us, or play a game of intense competitive chess, but rather enter into a state of stable absorption that, by extension, is, in Buddhism, the four so-called jhanas, these non-ordinary states of awareness that comprise the right concentration element of the Noble Eightfold Path. And I'm going to talk about that when I come back. I think that'll be the first Wednesday in May. All right? And that's pretty neat stuff, the jhanas. So tranquility leads to deep concentration, both at the edge of the jhanas and then all the way in to that pool, even out to the deep end of the pool where the fourth jhana is. And then that is a basis for a growing equanimity, equanimity being the seventh factor of awakening. And that's another very important topic to explore, both at the beginning, if you will, sense of equanimity, and then becoming progressively more profound. Equanimity is essentially a non-reactivity to our own reactions. In other words, tranquility, which I'm about to dive into, it's a state of being undisturbed, like a pond that's perfectly still. It's undisturbed. The body is very undisturbed. The mind is very undisturbed. The heart is undisturbed. That's a really good thing. But that state is a little fragile. You know, the wind comes along. It can ruffle the surface of the pond. Someone frowns at us. We get reactive. I actually had a funny moment. I'm getting ready to come here fairly quickly. I was moving to gather my stuff and leave my house and then make it here on time. And I turned in such a way that I had an imagined experience. And my imagined experience was that my wife had yet again left a cabinet door open, right at head height. She's shorter than I am. And I had bonked myself. I didn't actually have the experience. I just had this kind of vivid imagining of, wow, I wasn't alert. I didn't watch out, because sometimes she leaves that cabinet door open, and if she had, it would have been a really hard blow. So here I am. I'm having an imagined experience, and I'm suddenly reactivated. My pond is disturbed, right? I didn't jump out of my skin. I didn't yell at her. Nothing happened. That's the point. And yet, there was a kind of reaction that occurred. That's a disturbance of tranquility. Equanimity, which we'll get to in mid-May, is very deep in that you're so centered that even when things arise, they don't get to you. They don't really disturb you. In the language of the Buddha, they don't invade the mind and remain, right? They pass through and go on. And so you can see that calm is having no reactions. Tranquility is having no reactions. Equanimity is not reacting to our reactions. And it's easy to sustain tranquility, relatively easy, when we're not engaged with life, right? When you don't have a wife who leaves cabinet doors open, which then you worry about hitting, or, right, you're not having to get up and do things or talk with people or do your taxes, what have you. It's what the Buddha called a state of seclusion, in a sense, even psychological seclusion. But equanimity enables us to be in life, to be engaged in life, to deal with the winds of life, but to have such a deep keel in the water that our boat doesn't get tipped over or we recover very quickly. So that's the topic of equanimity. So into tranquility. It's very interesting the number of occasions in which there are references to tranquility as a major aid to practice. So first, what is tranquility? It doesn't necessarily mean this, it's on a continuum. In other words, often what we'll experience, and you may have experienced it tonight, is a moment of tranquility, a few seconds of a kind of fundamental peacefulness, and then there's more activity again. Or maybe for an exhalation, there's a sense of just letting go. It's a lot of letting go and tranquility. And with time, the ability to tranquilize oneself in a healthy sense starts to grow, and the depth of those moments of tranquility grows too. They get deeper and deeper, and they start to extend more and more into each other. And as I proceed here, I'll talk about a number of, I think, practical ways that are, some of which are informed by how the brain works, for deepening tranquility and being able to get back to it more and more quickly. So that's a basic state of tranquility. In, for example, the mindfulness of breathing practice that the Buddha laid out that has 16 steps, and he, by the way, said that mindfulness of breathing, when taken all the way out in these 16 steps, is in itself a sufficient path for full awakening. That's an impressive statement. He didn't say that about many things. He said that about mindfulness of breathing. He said that about the four foundations of mindfulness altogether, which include things besides the body. And he said that about love. He said love itself, when fully developed, when it fully takes us over and it fills us entirely and we're utterly given over to it, that too, beautifully, can be a sufficient path to full enlightenment. That's the short list, you know? Breathing, full mindfulness, and love. Pretty good. So, with regard to tranquility, in the mindfulness of breathing practice, it shows up several times, actually, as the steps, especially the kind of early to intermediate steps, to tranquilize breathing and the body altogether. I think that's from memory, I could be wrong, the fourth step, and then around the sixth step, it's to tranquilize the quality of the pleasant or unpleasant or neutral reactions to events. The hedonic tones of experience in Western psychology, also called the feeling tones in Buddhism. One is to bring a growing tranquility, not by numbing out, not by shutting down, but by pacifying, by helping the pawn to increasingly settle. And I'll talk about some of the ways to do that in just a minute or two. Also, one is to tranquilize the perception of things, the labeling of them or categorizing them. One is to relax the mental activity in the mindfulness of breathing steps, relaxing the mental activity that labels and categorizes and conceptualizes about things. You know, in other words, tranquility can come not just to the body and the breath, but it can also come to cognitive functions, mental functions of labeling, categorizing and conceptualizing, as well as to emotional functions of finding things pleasant or unpleasant, and certainly to reactions altogether. So that's tranquility. I think you've probably found that the benefits, why be tranquil? One, it feels good in its own right. Two, when we're in a state of relative peacefulness and non-reactivity, we are no longer putting logs on the fire of suffering. The Buddha repeatedly used the metaphor of fire and fuel, right? And the three main fuels named in Buddhism are what's called greed, broadly defined. That's a kind of grasping or a drivenness, gotta have it, wanna, my precious, you know, that whole possessiveness thing. That's greed. Second main poison, hatred, broadly defined, which ranges from subtle forms of exasperation and resentment and irritation all the way out to rage and lethal aggression. And the third great fuel on the fire of suffering is what the Buddha called delusion, or more really broadly, a state of ignorance, not really seeing how things really are, not understanding deeply that everything changes and nothing in and of itself is capable of being fundamentally fulfilling or satisfying or a fundamentally reliable basis for happiness. Not understanding that, not seeing that, that's ignorance. And I would call out explicitly a fourth fuel that's, I think, a major category of logs that go on the fire of suffering. It's implicit in a lot of what the Buddha said. And that fourth fuel, that fourth log, is heartache. Feelings of rejection, loneliness, clinging in relationships, looking for love in all the wrong places, working with shame, narcissistic injury, feeling like you've been voted off the island, etc. Those are logs that go on the fire of suffering too. When we're tranquil, we're not caught up in greed, hatred, delusion, or heartache. We're just not present. In that moment, we're having a taste of the awakened state. We're having a taste of Buddha mind. It may not be, and usually isn't, hasn't been in my case, deep and full and complete to the uttermost extent, but we're getting a taste of a mind that lacks the craving because it lacks the logs. It lacks greed, hatred, delusion, and heartache, and therefore it lacks the craving that drives suffering. In that moment, there's no suffering driven by craving. There may be pain, the body may hurt, there may be a sorrow in the back of the mind from a recent loss or a distant loss. There might be worry about something coming around the bend, but there's not suffering around that state of mind. So those are two reasons right there to enter a state of tranquility. One, it feels good in its own right. Two, it helps take some logs off the fire. We stop adding causes to our suffering or the suffering of other people. And the third main reason to be tranquil is that when the mind is that quiet, relatively quiet, it's much more possible to see clearly. In other words, if you want to see your face in the pond, if the surface of the pond is disturbed, you can't see your own reflection. Right? But when the surface of the pond is still, you can see more acutely what's really going on with one. Also, interestingly, to take this pond metaphor a little further, as the mind and the body and the heart grow more peaceful, they grow more settled. There's more letting go. There's less positionality. There's less upset. There's less craving going on. As that happens, the sediments, if you will, in the pond start settling down. They settle out more and more. The pond is increasingly not muddy. And to use the Tibetan metaphor, what we begin to be able to see is the jewels at the bottom of the pond. The jewels in our own nature, the really beautiful qualities in our own heart or in the hearts of other people. Those jewels have been there all along. They were simply obscured by the busyness and the upsets and the things arising, the clutter, the clouding in the agitated mind. But as the mind becomes less and less agitated through a growing tranquility, we can really see those treasures. So pause, any comments or questions so far, and then I'll segue into a variety of ways to cultivate tranquility. Yeah?
The 8 steps of what, and what is the 8-step samadhi?
Okay, so I was referring to, and by the way, I so appreciate it when I roll on at my usual fire hose pace, and someone says, wait a second, 8 what, or something. That's really great. 4 noble truths, right? The first truth is the reality of suffering, broadly defined. The second noble truth being the cause of suffering, which is to say, craving. This is the Buddhist model. See for yourself if you think it's true. The third noble truth is that which undoes the cause of suffering, which is the abandonment of craving in all of its forms. And then in the fourth noble truth, that's the path that leads to the abandonment of craving and thus to the end of all suffering, which is not a blank. It's not a void or a zero. The end of all suffering, as the Buddha said, is the highest happiness, which is peace, which tranquility, sidebar, is gives us a good taste of. So that's the fourth. What is that path? And the Buddha said there are eight aspects to that path. Right or wise view, we see clearly. I'll just say right intention. And then also right livelihood, right action, and right speech, very important. It's interesting how much emphasis the Buddha placed on interpersonal conduct. And then the remaining is right effort, where we basically pull weeds and plant flowers in the garden of the mind, thus the brain, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And right concentration is listed usually last, although the Noble Eightfold Path isn't so much a sequence as it's a variety of things that work together in almost a spiraling kind of way. It's more of a like eight sectors that we spiral through over and over, getting deeper and deeper in them. So that's what I was referring to there. Oh, I've got two lists here.
Tranquility, deconcentration, equanimity,
and... Okay, so we have two lists, and as people have teased him forever, can you imagine the Buddha at a roast, one of these things they put a president in or a celebrity roast? He was a list maker. So I've got two lists on the table here. The one I started with was the seven factors of enlightenment, and the one I just named there was the Eightfold Path. What's interesting is the things that show up on multiple lists, because then you think to yourself, wow, that's really on the Buddha's greatest hits, right? And one that shows up on multiple lists especially is mindfulness. It's interesting. Also, bliss shows up on multiple lists. And so that's the distinction. You know, the seven factors of awakening culminate in equanimity. The Noble Eightfold Path, has its eight elements that I just named there. That's great. You pick just one thing, not to shamelessly grab the title of my book, but if you pick just one thing and zero in on it for a while, that can be really a great focus, like tranquility. Like you might just take, till we meet again, till I'm here again, the theme of peacefulness or tranquility in your life. You know, what's it like? Do you value it? Can you make room for it? What are the causes that evaporate it or cloud it or disturb it or agitate it? You know, how can you create more sanctuary for yourself? How can you make tranquility sacred in some sense in your own life? Or at least a moment each day that is actually tranquil. Maybe one more person?
You say that it's a fair statement that any one of these areas can be an opening to the whole system.
That's great you said that. That's exactly right. Any one of these factors, let's say, like equanimity, or concentration or tranquility or mindfulness can connect you to the whole thing. I think like a lot of things, there's a phase we go through where we don't know much about something, and then we learn more about it, and it's kind of complicated and confusing. And then we get past that, and it sort of gets simple again. And I'd really just encourage you, I think there's a place for understanding the ideas and seeing how they work, but it's really important not to intellectualize around them too much. Once you get a basic clarity, bring it back into your practice. What does it feel like to be tranquil? What's it like to investigate, to look into something? What's it like to have energy? What's it like to speak with wisdom? What's it like? What's it like to have wholesome, good intentions? What's that like? And what gets in the way of it? And I like to talk about how to be more tranquil. Do you think we live in a tranquil society? I laugh. Here I am, blazing out of my house, working in my mind about the virtual banging my head on the cabinet door event that did not actually occur, jumping into my car and going, holy moly, I need to get there quickly, to teach about tranquility, right? So, welcome to the modern world, which to me, in effect, is an argument that we really, really need to build up our muscles of tranquility, because we've got to carry a real weight of disturbance and agitation and stress and busyness. So a couple of a variety of points here, actually, about ways that you might look at yourself. Wow, if I buy this idea that this mental state, this mental factor of tranquility would be of value to me, whether it's for ordinary just well-being or resilience, dealing with the stresses, the challenges I have in my life, or even as a kind of positive log on a different kind of fire that takes me down the path of awakening. If I do value it, how can I make it more alive in my life? So I want to suggest a variety of possible things. One is to kind of ask yourself if you're willing to make room for tranquility, because we become habituated to busyness and agitation. We get used to the drama, storm und Drang, right? We get used to it, and we start feeling, like we're not getting enough stimulation if we don't have it. It's a real question. Is it a value? Another question or thing you can do is notice how it feels. And I don't know about you, to me it feels good. It's a relief, it's a settling, it's a letting go, it's an easing, there's a sense of coming home. I think about like animals, like horses, that get more, where's Fran there? Yeah, there you are, works with horses, get more tranquil. You could just feel almost sympathetically, empathically with them, how good it feels to just, like a child even. I like the poet Mary Oliver's line, the soft animal of the body, helping the soft animal of the body become more peaceful. It's really a pleasant, positive experience, isn't it? And by recognizing and internalizing the positive experience of this, we can become increasingly inclined in that direction. Another thing that aids tranquility has to do with a wing of the nervous system called the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system. It's the antidote to the fight or flight sympathetic wing of the autonomic nervous system. And we evolved both. They're both important. The sympathetic fight or flight stress response wing gets us up and going. If a tiger's chasing after us, gets us excited. If something really neat has happened, gets involved in making love. But a little bit of the sympathetic nervous system can go a long way, because more than that little bit starts having accumulating negative impacts on our physical and mental health through various chronic stress pathways. The antidote is the parasympathetic wing. It's sometimes called the rest and digest rather than fight or flight wing of the nervous system. And a variety of things activated, it's very cooling. The Buddha also used a lot of language of cooling. Cooling the fires, all right? So one thing that activates the parasympathetic wing is long exhalations. You've probably found other ways that work for you. I think at a time when most people on most days are experiencing chronic, low-grade, mild to moderate, not always low-grade, mild to moderate stress as just a way of life, it really behooves us to master a calming, soothing response where we protect ourselves and stop letting those things out there really rattle us so much. So that's a third thing about tranquility. You know, getting more and more able to relax the body at will. To be honest, I did have that upset happen. I was really startled by this anger response in me to an event that did not occur, bonking my head on the cabinet door. But through practice, through habit, very quickly, within a couple dozen seconds, I was into the calming, cooling cascade. Settle down, exhale, come back to center, get off the ledge, Rick, you know. Little things like that. So getting better and better at that, that's a nice pathway to tranquility. And we do this both online in the moment by mounting a calming response, and we can do it offline by training ourselves through relaxation training, yoga, progressive relaxation, other things like that, to kind of reset the resting state of relaxation or not in our body. Another thing that I found very helpful for tranquility is a little trick from psychotherapy for anxiety. And if you locate your diaphragm, it's the muscle just underneath the inverted V of the rib cage, right around the solar plexus area. If you breathe into the diaphragm, and you have a particular, you bring attention to the diaphragm area when you breathe, that has a special impact on reducing anxiety. And anxiety is one of the primary disturbers of tranquility. We're very prone to anxiety as a species, right? It's natural to be anxious, but when you're anxious, when you feel threatened, you're not tranquil. So if you want to help tranquilize yourself and you're doing mindfulness of breathing, do mindfulness of breathing in the diaphragm. And every minute or so, without pressing about it, just encourage a wave of relaxation coming through your diaphragm, a wave of easing, slowing down, letting the breath gentle, not suppressing it, not numbing, not disowning the feelings, but encouraging that calming wave in a part of the body that then helps the whole body settle down and feel less anxious. It's kind of a nice method, isn't it? Next to last suggestion? Yeah, Fran.
I was just going to mention that all that you've been talking about will lower your blood pressure.
Yeah, in a positive way, especially if you have high blood pressure. Yeah, that's exactly right. So next to last, and I'll end real close to 8:30, maybe a couple minutes past, but pretty close. Next to last is to deliberately do some times of formal practice. Meditate a minute or more a day, or other occasions, maybe with yoga, even using other things like Pilates or other forms of body training. Walking the dog, or walking, just going out and going for a walk by oneself. One doesn't need a dog to go for a walk, all right? At these formal moments, bring in some tranquility. Maybe at a moment of grace for half a minute at a meal. A formal, deliberate attempt to move into a state of tranquility, characterized by really letting go. It's interesting, Ajahn Chah, great Southeast Asian Buddhist teacher in Thailand, had a very memorable saying. I recall it quite often. He said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little happiness. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of happiness. And if you let go completely, you'll be completely happy. And that kind of letting go is a real pathway into tranquility, and tranquility is also a way to let go. So some formal times, some formal moments where there's a focus on tranquility. And meditation, you know, from time to time, ask yourself, what's the state of tranquility in the mind? And see if you can gently call in tranquility as a mental factor for deepening your own meditation. And then the last thing to say that I'll say right now about tranquility and ways into it is, and if this is meaningful to you, to sense the fundamental underlying tranquility under everything. So minimally sensing into a kind of underpinnings, a kind of container in the mind itself that is undisturbed, such as awareness itself. Awareness is like a screen, like a TV screen, or the sky. Things pass through it, but as with a TV screen, the screen itself, its capacity to represent images, is never disturbed by the images that pass through it. So we can intuit and sense that there is a space within us, or a field within us, or a wellspring within us, or a place of beingness within us that is always undisturbed, even if the contents are far from tranquil. We can intuit that. We can sense that, if that's meaningful for you. In other words, we can be upset while also having a sense of an underlying tranquility that is not itself upset. I sometimes think of being in the ocean while there's a raging storm. On the surface of the sea, obviously, it would be very agitated. But 20 feet down, 10 feet down even, 30 feet down for sure, it would be very quiet. Even if a hurricane were going overhead, you'd hardly feel it at all. It's like that. You sense down into it. And if this, to take it one step further, is meaningful to you, we can intuit what the Buddha called the unconditioned, you know, a space that does not itself change, out of which everything that changes arises and passes away. It's important to not turn the unconditioned into a thing, because then it becomes just another object of attachment and craving, identification, sets us up to suffer. But if we can actually start to intuit that just before things appear and become agitated, there's a fundamental space that's mysterious. It's truly beyond language. It's incapable of being defined in any way, because as soon as you attempt to define it, you're in the realm of things that have taken form rather than the realm of that which is just prior, moment to moment to moment, to things taking form. But, you know, one can really have an intuition. Sometimes it's just a very quick intuition. It's often, actually, just a very quick intuition, but it has a deepening sense of conviction for one. And that underlying unconditioned space is obviously, you know, profoundly tranquil. If that's not even almost that's a word that would point at it. Obviously, it goes far, far beyond that. But we can have that kind of intuition, particularly growing over time with practice. And if you don't relate to the last couple things I've said here, that's really fine. So maybe a comment or question or two, and then we'll wrap it up for tonight.
A lot of what you've gone through in the past few minutes, you put forward in terms of you can do these things. And yet we also hear that this self is really not there. I hear in this last, mm-hmm. very last one, we can intuit the unconditioned space that underlies everything else. Isn't that really non-self, the mm-hmm. non-self? Where you've really released all this other stuff and
Yeah, okay. So, so it's great. Okay, so let's be clear, though, the words. We're persons. In other words, we're body minds. We're individuals. We have a brain. We have a body. We have a mind, right? You're different from me. I'm different from Tarane. We're distinct. Persons can be aware of things. Persons can have intentions. Persons can start bringing their attention to the fact that's amazing, actually, that all kinds of things appear and pass away in awareness, but awareness itself remains stable. It itself is not agitated. Okay? It itself is not angry or happy or jealous or bored. It itself is never agitated. Okay, we can see that, and that's okay. It's also the case, and this is way too much to talk more than 30 seconds about right now, that the presumed I, the one we presume is looking through the eyes, you know, the one we think of when we say, I want a cookie, or do you love me, right? We can observe over time, first, that the sense of that I is always just one more mental content that arises and passes away. It's not categorically different from any other mental content, any other sight, sound, perception, thought, emotion, wish, hope, memory, whatever. It's just one more mental content. And that right there starts disentangling us. The Buddha also used the language of entanglement a lot, and disentanglement. We start disentangling from the presumption of that I, and we stop, therefore, taking life so personally, increasingly over time. The other thing we start to recognize is that sense of I that arises and then passes away, if you actually look closely at it, which usually happens when you kind of stop and you just replay the instant replay, the last 5 seconds of experience. And then you look closely at that particular sense of I itself as a mental content, you discover that in that sense of I is never happiness, is never real happiness. It's never in it, right? And what happens over time is you start to increasingly relax out of the I and relax into more and more the person. You know, Dogen, the great Zen teacher, had a very powerful summary. He says to study the way, this path of awakening, this path of practice, is to study the self, the I. Not the person, but the presumed I. Second, to study the I, to investigate it, to bring mindfulness to it, to observe it directly, is gradually to release or relax the I. To release or relax the I, he then concludes, is to become illuminated by all things. as the attachment to me, myself, and I starts to fall away, and we relax out and into, we open out into person, and then by extension out into the intertwining world, it becomes increasingly that which informs us and breathes us. And we can get heady about that. That's a trap. The trick is to appreciate concept, you know, appreciate clear thinking. The Buddha was a fan of right view, you know, clarity of thought. But most importantly, it's to bring it into our own experience. So as we become more tranquil, maybe I'll finish on this point. As we become more tranquil, it's very interesting what starts to happen. You may have experienced it just simply tonight in a very, very ordinary and embodied kind of way. There you are, sitting, breathing, awareness is ongoing, right? Basic sense of relaxation, a door closes loudly, irritation arises in the mind, passes away, it's all okay, no problem. And then it's very interesting, there's this growing awareness, whoa, there's ongoingness of being, it has continuity, it's located here in this chair, not in the chair where the person breathing next to me is sitting, and wow, there's really not much sense of I here, if any sense of I at all, and it's still okay. Breathing's ongoing, thought is occurring, intentions, good intentions are arising, it's all okay, and there's really not that much sense of an I. So maybe that's a fourth good reason to practice tranquility. And I want to just really end on this one thing, and then I'll stop, and I'll stick around a little bit if you want to talk. The thing is, what I'm doing with you in this little run of teaching I'm doing, we're going under the hood. In other words, this is the toolbox, this is the hardcore toolbox, if you will, the Buddha laid out. And it's sometimes easy to get complicated about it or to think that it's esoteric or not reserved for me. If you can, I really encourage you in this direction, it's what I've tried to do myself, is to relate to these words in their plain English form as very direct instructions or coaching about that which leads to certain results, and to take them at face value, take them in their plain meaning, and then locate the experiential referent for these words, for tranquility or peacefulness or distinguishing between a sense of ongoing beingness as a person, as a whole body mind, and what it feels like to take things personally or to get caught up in me and possessiveness or, you know, wanting to glamorize oneself, right? We can do that. And so I really encourage you, just, you know, we can all do this. That's what the Buddha said. He said all people can do this. You have to make efforts. We have to make efforts, but we can do this. Right? We can become increasingly tranquil. Okay, so let's sit for a minute and just kind of let it sink in, and then we'll wrap up. Thank you for your attention and your practice.